From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. As the battle to put the global economy back on an even keel continues, President Barack Obama is facing opposition from a number of Republicans and from some key Democratic figures as he continues to shape his budget. His $410 billion budget comes after billions have already been put aside for the economic stimulus package, but how much more money is the commander-in-chief going to need to address some of society's key issues? To explain more now, I am joined by NPR's senior Washington editor, Ron Elving. Hello, Ron.
Good to be with you, Tony.
So we've had the stimulus package. $787 billion has been set aside to try to kickstart the economy and the omnibus spending bill. So, Ron, let's separate these piles of money, okay?
Good idea.
The first the $410 billion is for what? Describe some of its key elements.
All right. The $410 billion is really old news. That is the omnibus appropriations package left over for the current fiscal year, which began back on October 1st. It's business that was transacted between President George W. Bush and the 110th Congress. And it's been left around, never got approved. Essentially, the two sides agreed to disagree in advance of the election and to wait and let the next Congress and the new president, whoever that would be, fight it out in the new year. And it's taken several months for them to fight it out in the new year, but it is basically a budget that was agreed on for the current fiscal year way back between those earlier players. And President Obama decided he's got plenty of other things on his hands. He's got the stimulus bill. He's got his budget for next year, his own first budget. And he's got the mortgage bailout plan, the bank bailout plan, and a lot of other issues that he wants to get to in foreign policy and domestic policy. So he just let last year's business be last year's business and let that go through as it was, $410 billion.
Now, we do not have a figure yet, do we, for the president's proposals for his next budget?
Well, it's going to be an enormous budget. It's going to be several trillion dollars. It's going to have the biggest built-in deficit we've ever had. The current year will run up the biggest deficit we've ever had. It'll be well over $1 trillion, and it'll probably be well over $1 trillion for the first Obama budget as well, although the president pledges that he will ratchet that down each year and expects to cut it in half, cut this year's, if you will, hangover Bush deficit in half by the end of his first term.
Now, the budget has been criticized by some economists who say that the plan is too optimistic, and the GOP Senate leader Mitch McConnell says the plan has three flaws in his view, which are it spends, number one, taxes, number two, and borrows too much, number three. But there are even some Democratic heavyweights, Ron, who have key roles in devising this budget plan who disagree with some of President Obama's ideas. We're going to hear from one of them shortly, Ways and Means Chairman Charles Rangel. But my question for you is this code for leave my earmarks alone?
The earmark is an important part of the disagreement between this administration, the Obama administration, and the Congress, as the Congress has pretty much always been. We didn't always call them earmarks. We used to have various and sundry other ways of getting special pork spending into the bill for the use of particular senators in their state or for particular districts and their congressmen. This has been part of getting people to go along with bills they otherwise might be somewhat embarrassed to vote for a very long time, for generations in Congress, because any bill is going to look big in the context of its own time, and that big spending bill can be justified back home much more easily if it includes a bridge, or it includes money for a local college, or it includes some other special project that the folks back home are all for. If the congressman brings that home, he's a hero. If other congressmen are bringing the same thing home to their districts, then we call them earmarks, and they become unpopular. They become pork barrel spending, and everybody wants to run against it.
I've got time for one more question, about a minute or so, Ron. It's this. Is the president's spending proposal likely to run into a bipartisan buzzsaw the same way that the stimulus did?
If it does, it will be highly successful because the stimulus had a lot of opposition, but it passed. It got 60 votes in the Senate, which meant several Republicans had to vote for it. If the president is as successful with his own budget and with, let's say, the health care overhaul, he wants to overhaul the entire health care delivery system in this country, and such things as rebalancing the energy and environment issues, if he is as successful with those things as he was with the economic stimulus package, which got passed despite the buzzsaw, he will be one successful president in the first year in office.
Ron Elving, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Tony.
That was Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor. He joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Well, one of the key Democrats who has spoken out against elements of President Obama's budget plan is Congressman Charles Rangel. He is House Representative for New York's 15th District and chair of the House Committee on Ways and Means. He joins us now. Congressman, welcome to News and Notes.
Good to be with you again.
Let's get right to the nuts and bolts, Congressman.
Why not?
We've had a string of financial measures passed by Congress, from the stimulus to the bank bailout to the new $410 billion budget. But as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, you are one of the congressional leaders who is expected to support the president while also protecting the interests of your constituents. Does this budget allow you to do that, and to what degree?
Well, it's going to be difficult because of the cost of so many things that our president is calling for. We're going to have to make a lot of painful political decisions, but we are confident that we wish really we could persuade the Republicans, but we are confident that we'll have enough votes in the House to reach the number of votes that we need to pass the president's budget. And a lot of it has to do with the president's dreams and aspirations and the things that we will have to be able to sell our colleagues as to how important it's going to be with the overwhelming expenses of the recovery package, that we concern ourselves with the future of our kids and our children's children.
Well, let me ask you some specifics, because the president has made an issue of earmarks generally, but there is already pushback from both sides of the aisle. Realistically, Congressman Rangel, how much actual reform is likely to get passed with regard to these earmarks?
Well, I would say, Tony, at a very minimum, that if there's anyone, you know, I don't take the position that that's the national administration, Republican or Democrat, know what's best in terms of infrastructure for our congressional district. And since we're not adding anything, but in terms of appropriations, we've been assisted by our local officials in identifying. I've been here 38 years, and every group that I've helped has either been a nonprofit or a government group, a school, a hospital. And so to me, I always oppose these things, earmarks being put into a budget or appropriation bill without any fingerprints on it. I've always taken the position, I still hold on to it, that if a member is proud and transparent and is willing to not only put his name on it, but to put his legislative reputation on it, I don't have any problem in debating with this or any other president that earmarks are good for the country and good for our congressional districts.
But this puts you on a collision course with the President Obama, a direct collision course, doesn't it?
I've had a lot of people ask me questions like that because I disagree with a great president, and I just don't like the word collision. I kind of believe that the White House, the executive branch, is supposed to tell the Congress what it needs and what it wants, with the understanding that if you agree with me on the principle, and which we do, then you come up with a better idea of how to raise the revenue.
Well, the president has put forward an ambitious domestic agenda in his first couple of months in office: education, health care, Iraq drawdown, earmarks.
I cannot begin to tell you the how my heart beats faster when you just repeat these cold facts, but what it means to people in communities such as mine, the number of jobs, the educational opportunity, the kids that would be finishing school, the AmeriCorps, to me, it is one of the most, notwithstanding the fiscal crises and the fact that this budget is going to be tight in order to make certain that there's a pay for at the end, to me, this is a revolution that's going to improve the quality of health, competition, housing, the whole works. So Well, yes, I hated to interrupt, but those things are just more than words to me.
Well, I was going to go beyond just the economy in terms of the president's agenda to talk about some of the other areas, and there have been many, including, again, stem cell research, the drawdown from Iraq. My question was going to be, sir, is this an overly ambitious, a too ambitious agenda for the beginning of a new presidency?
If he had decided to go slower, and people would be critical of him, I would be one of his first defenders and say, give the guy a chance and let him go at a slower pace. If it was just an ordinary, bland president, we'd say, hey, let's take one step at a time. But I think he's got America excited, and it could very well be the broader the agenda, the more people find what they would like to see in terms of the environment and health reform and a better school system and improving trade. It could very well be that he's getting America back to a spirit of can do, we can do it, at a time when we really need a shot in the arm because of the stock market and the failure of our banking institution.
Congressman, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for calling me.
That was Congressman Charles Rangel. He is the House Representative for New York's 15th District and also Chair of the House Ways and Means Committee.
Indian filmmakers created Bollywood, but have you heard about Nollywood? We're talking about the Nigerian film industry, and it's largely unknown outside of Africa. Over the past 10 years, Nollywood has grown into a $250 million a year enterprise that employs thousands of people. Now the documentary Welcome to Nollywood gives us a behind-the-scenes look at Nigerian filmmakers and their impact on African culture.
Nollywood films are so popular around Africa because people can relate to the stories that we do.
We are telling African stories from an African perspective, slow, very dialogue-oriented because we are a speaking people.
NPR's Tony Cox sat down with the documentary's director, Jamie Meltzer, plus Nigerian film director Izu Ojukwu.
Let's start with this. Izu, the film industry in Nigeria, most people do not associate it with movie making, but apparently movie making is really a big deal there.
Yeah. Nigerians call them home videos, you know, so that will get away with a lot of things easily. Yeah.
Instead of saying movies, they say home videos.
Yeah, they call them home videos back home. Yeah.
Well, home videos in the States mean something entirely different,
I suppose. Yeah.
But how big is the home video business in Nigeria?
It's very big. It is next to the oil in Nigeria. It's very big. It has taken thousands of youths off the streets, you know, in different aspects.
Which kind of movie, which genre of home video is the one that is the most popular?
Comedy.
Comedy?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Jamie, welcome.
Thank you.
You did a documentary about Nollywood, as it's called. What we are talking about, did it come as a surprise to you to discover what's occurring?
It did. It really did. I first heard about Nollywood when I was finishing up a previous documentary. A documentary had taken me about 4 or 5 years to complete, which is not unusual. At that time, I read about Nollywood in the paper, where they're finishing films, you know, in a couple weeks and then putting them out to the market and having immediate successes with their films. So basically, for me, the film was about seeing the model that the Nigerian independent filmmakers had set up as an inspiration for all independent filmmakers, including myself.
What is it about that model? Is it, A, the speed with which these films are being produced, the distribution system that they have, the low overhead that perhaps they may have? What is it that you feel is worth modeling yourself after or others here in the States?
Well, it's a little bit more abstract than that for me. For me, it's about an example, in other words, an example of filmmakers kind of making the best situation out of what they have, and that's certainly what they've done in Nigeria. In Lagos, where most of my documentary was shot and where Izu works all the time as a director, power is hardly on, you know, for most of the day. So how do you shoot a film when you don't have lights, when you don't have power? You know, you make do. You figure out a way around it. How do you make a film when there's no financing from banks or from, you know, or the government. You know, you find entrepreneurs, you know, to invest, and, you know, you do it with small amounts of money. So it's just the way in which they figured out, according to their own circumstances and context, how to make a film industry work is just sort of an example to inspire everyone to try to do the same within their own context. You know, in other words,
in the documentary, we saw just what Jamie was talking about, power going out, money coming up short, disgruntled actors, all of that, and then having a place to distribute your work. Quantity is one thing. Quality is another. As frankly as you can, talk about the quality of these films, these home videos that are being made in Nigeria. Are they any good?
From Nigerian action master Izu Ojukwu, a tale of conspiracy at the upper echelons of power. Who will tell the president?
Well, majority of the filmmakers in Nigeria basically do these things to survive. And you know, the dark age of military regime in my country sort of set things back. The filmmakers couldn't afford to move forward. So an alternative solution was created, you know, to get your camera out, shoot something, and then we have to survive. But now it's changing gradually. People are beginning, professionals, you know, trained filmmakers are coming in. They're coming back to the business again, and they're trying to revive the industry.
How do you handle distribution, and how are people able to actually see the work that you produce?
Well, in Nigeria, at least, we have a very good distribution network in Nigeria for our local consumers. So generally, the marketers have outlets all scattered all over the country. So once a movie is released, they get their distributors and it gets to the, you know, consumers.
Jamie, what's the purpose of the documentary that you did about Nigerian filmmaking besides to expose it to the rest of the world that may not know what's taking place there?
I think, for me, the film is also about showing a different side of Africa at large, because I think in the U.S., as consumers of media, we don't really get a fair picture of what's going on in Africa, of the complexity of African countries and people. And so I thought this kind of a film that focuses on a very positive part of African life and something that Nigerian directors and filmmakers and producers, you know, creating this industry on their own, you know, have created something without any outside support or anything like that. That kind of story, again, that inspirational kind of story, for me, felt very different than any other stories I'd seen being represented in our media about Africa. And to me, that was kind of an important point that I wanted to get across.
Izu, just a couple of more things. How difficult is it to do some of the more complicated kinds of crash scenes and explosions and things, fires and all that stuff that you see in action films? In the documentary, they showed how, you know, you guys put the blood in the water when they had the war scene and stuff. How hard is it to get those things that Hollywood is now generating via computer?
It is difficult, you know, in the sense like in the movie I shot while Jamie was in Nigeria, it took me 7 months to get the attention of the Nigerian army. And it's the first time they would give that kind of support to an independent filmmaker, to any filmmaker at all. So I stayed and then, you know, was constantly visiting the Army headquarters until the Army Chief of Staff, you know, approved those props. And I had bomb engineers, you know, on set. So, I mean, it's the first time anything like that is happening in Nigeria. So it indicates that the future is bright for the Nigerian movie industry.
Jamie, you want to add anything to that, what you've seen in comparing films made in Nollywood versus those you've seen made in Hollywood?
You know, there's all kinds of films being made in Nigeria, political thrillers and action movies. And so it's a really interesting industry to me in terms of, you know, continually defining itself and redefining itself. It's also very responsive to the news cycle. I mean, think about it. In the U.S., we can't be as responsive to our news cycle because it takes us several years to make a film. But in Nigeria, if you can make a film in a month or 6 weeks and get it out, you can be really responsive to what's happening in the news media. So there was a lot of talk about those kinds of films, whether it reflect political reality or some sort of social reality.
Jamie, Isu, thank you both.
Thank you.
Fascinating. Good
Thanks.
Luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Jamie Meltzer, director of the documentary Welcome to Nollywood, along with Nigerian film director Izu Ojukwu. They spoke with NPR's Tony Cox.
What would the movie Jaws be without that deep bass cello refrain? Or Psycho without the shrieking strings during that shower scene? Memorable films are often infused with a great musical score. ASCAP, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, runs a summer boot camp for hopeful composers. The annual summer film scoring workshop selects a dozen applicants from hundreds of hopefuls. The workshop closes with the participants conducting their music on a soundstage with a live orchestra. Michael Bearden, a product of the ASCAP workshop, has since scored Spike Lee and Vanessa Williams productions, and he joins us right now here in our studios at NPR West. Michael, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Let's begin with this. How did the ASCAP workshop prepare you for the real-world pressures of Hollywood film scoring?
The first thing that I learned at the ASCAP film scoring workshop is there are a lot of talented composers out here. And it prepares you in a way that they only give you a certain amount of time to score for a big Hollywood scene. And then it's pretty much like the real live pressures of how we score today. And we're given an orchestra to score, like a big 80-piece plus orchestra at the Fox scoring stage. And they'll show us a scene, and then we'll just have to score for it.
Really, you scored a 2006 documentary about the career of U.S. Representative Cynthia McKinney. Mm-hmm. We happen to have a piece of that music. Let's take a listen to it. This is a track from American Blackout. So, Michael, tell us, what were you thinking about when you composed that music, and how do you translate the look and the tone of a film into an effective score?
That's a great question. Usually a director will give you some kind of direction as to what kind of mood he wants or she wants, and you have to interpret that language into musical language. So American Blackout is about the voter disenfranchisement of 2000 and 2004 with that whole voting debacle that happened. And so you have to kind of synthesize that into how it would feel and how it sounds, how the mood of it is. And so pretty much, that's how you do it. You just get the feel of it and then try to interpret it musically.
Describe how that feels different than just composing music generally. I know you don't have the film element when you're just composing music.
And that's the exact thing. You don't have the visual element. The visual element pretty much dictates what it should be, unless you're just trying to go for something different. If you see something funny on there and then you have a scary, like you said, cello drone as far as Jaws, it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't match unless that's the element that you're trying to go for. So you're just trying to match the mood of what the visual is dictating to you. Now, what does scary sound like? What does happy sound like? What does warm sound like? That's up to a lot of composers' interpretation, but you can pretty much get the gist of, there's a big vocabulary of what that kind of feels like already.
You know, it seems like that would be a great thing to do, very creative. What does warm sound like?
Yeah.
You know, just thinking about that. What challenges, or what would you say some of the bigger challenges are trying to come up and meet those things that we just discussed?
The challenges are, for me, and I think a lot of composers, is just not to display your talent so much. What I mean by that is you want to do everything you know. Oh, you've trained and you have this thing, you go, oh, I want to show them this, but it might not call for that. As a friend of mine who's a great composer said, if they ask you for a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, just give them that.
That's interesting. In film scoring,
yes,
is less more?
Less is more. The thing about film scoring that you want is, once again, the visual dictates everything. So if you're walking out of the theater humming the score, you didn't do a good job.
Oh, that's interesting. So you want to feel it but not think about it.
You want to feel it and not think about it. It's this whole other dimension that adds to the scariness or the funniness or whatever the mood is.
Well, how'd you get to that from what I'm going to talk about now, which was being Madonna's music director for 9 years? That seems like a quantum leap to me.
Have you ever seen a Madonna show?
Actually, I have not.
Well, she's very visual in what she does, and as well as all the artists that I work for. And And what they try to do is create a mood on stage in a short amount of time. And so it's pretty much just a natural, it's not a natural leap to be a musical director for a pop star than to actually score a film, but it's the same sensitivity as far as evoking mood from a crowd or trying to set a mood on stage, doing costume changes or lighting transitions or that kind of thing. And I've just always been intrigued by film scores and what they did and how they made you feel after you've viewed the film.
What's your training in? Is it in music or what exactly?
I started playing. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I started playing when I was around 5 years old. And, you know, I played with everybody pretty much you can name. Just a lot of a varied just array of different artists, from Liza Minnelli to Madonna to D'Angelo to whatever hip hop guy to Boss Gags to whom.
Oh, you're not kidding. You played with everybody.
I mean, pretty much everybody. And so my training was pretty much that. I call it street university.
You like this better?
I like it better because I don't have to get on a plane.
Well, I suppose, but what if a movie, well, I guess you're right. Even if a movie is done overseas, you don't necessarily have to go there.
Well, what I mean by that, Tony, is I remember the first tour I did with Whitney, I think we did about 18 months, like off and on the road, on buses, on planes, on that, and that kind of thing can just really drain you. Right now, you know, I can have a meeting with a director and it's down the street from my house. So I prefer that right now.
You're involved in a project. We're going to play it in a moment. Are you excited about this newest piece of film scoring that you're doing?
Which one is it?
The one that I have here is Rosa's Lament.
That's an old film that I did. It's a film called Constellation that's actually out right now. I think it's on cable now. I saw it on cable the other day.
Oh, you're smiling. You liked it, huh?
I like that film. It was a different kind of film. It was with Billy Dee Williams, Ray Don Chong, I think Leslie Ann Warren, Zoe Saldana's in it, Clarence Williams III is in it, and it's a lot of, Hill Harper's in it. It's a varied cast, and I like ensemble art type pieces.
You know, we had Billy Dee Williams in here talking about that film. As we're going to go out with a score from it. The song is called Rosa's Lament. Michael Bearden, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having
me. That's beautiful. Michael Bearden is a keyboardist, arranger, and composer of film scores. He joined us right here in our studios at NPR West. And that's News and Notes. Nicole Childers and Christabel and Sia Boati produced the show. Sasha Woodruff is our editor. Kenya Young and Devin Robbins are the directors. Our technical director is Shireen Strausberg. Marcia Caldwell, the drive engineer. Our staff includes Farah Chidea, Roy Hurst, Jeffrey Bennett, Jeffrey Gardner, True Tewksbury, and Zachary Slovig. Our interns are Blake Ashton and Ashley Listening. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit the website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for our newsletter, visit the blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Here is another listener favorite. Indian filmmakers created Bollywood, but have you heard about Nollywood? We're talking about the Nigerian film industry, which is largely unknown outside of Africa. Over the past 10 years, Nollywood has grown into a $250 million a year enterprise that employs thousands of people. Now, the documentary Welcome to Nollywood gives us a behind-the-scenes look at Nigerian filmmakers and their impact on African culture. I spoke with the documentary's director, Jamie Meltzer, and Nigerian film director Izu Ojukwu about the popularity of filmmaking in Nigeria.
Nigerians call them home videos. You know, so that we'll get away with a lot of things easily. Yeah.
Instead of saying movies, they say home videos.
Yeah. Call them home videos back home. Yeah.
Well, home videos in the States mean something entirely different,
I suppose. Yeah.
Well, how big is the home video business in Nigeria?
It's very big. It is next to the oil in Nigeria. It's very big. It has taken thousands of youths off the streets, you know, in different aspects.
Which kind of movie, which genre of home video is the one that is the most popular?
Comedy.
Comedy?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Jamie, welcome.
Thank you.
You did a documentary about Nollywood, as it's called. What we are talking about, did it come as a surprise to you to discover what's occurring?
It did. It really did. I first heard about Nollywood when I was finishing up a previous documentary, a documentary that had taken me about 4 or 5 years to complete, which is not unusual. At that time, I read about Nollywood in the paper, where they're finishing films, you know, in a couple weeks and then putting them out to the market and having immediate successes with their films. So basically for me, the film was about seeing the model that the Nigerian independent filmmakers had set up as an inspiration for all independent filmmakers, including myself.
What is it about that model? Is it A, the speed with which these films are being produced, the distribution system that they have, the low overhead that perhaps they may have? What is it that you feel is worth modeling yourself after or others here in the States?
Well, it's a little bit more abstract than that for me. For me, it's about an example, in other words, an example of filmmakers kind of making the best situation out of what they have, and that's certainly what they've done in Nigeria. In Lagos, where most of my documentary was shot and where Izu works all the time as a director, power is hardly on, you know, for most of the day. So how do you shoot a film when you don't have lights, when you don't have power? You know, you make do. You figure out a way around it. How do you make a film when there's no financing from banks or from, you know, or the government? You know, you find entrepreneurs, you know, to invest, and, you know, you do it with small amounts of money. So it's just the way in which they figured out, according to their own circumstances and context, how to make a film industry work is just sort of an example to inspire everyone to try to do the same within their own context. You know, in other words,
in the documentary, we saw just what Jamie was talking about, power going out, money coming up short, disgruntled actors, mm-hmm. all of that, and then having a place to distribute your work. Quantity is one thing. Quality is another. As frankly as you can, talk about the quality of these films, these home videos that are being made in Nigeria. Are they any good?
From Nigerian action master Izu Ojukwu, a tale of conspiracy at the upper echelons of power. Who will tell the president?
Well, majority of the filmmakers in Nigeria basically do these things to survive. And you know, the dark age of military regime in my country sort of set things back. The filmmakers couldn't afford to move forward. So an alternative solution was created, you know, to get your camera out, shoot something, and then we have to survive. But now it's changing gradually. People are beginning, professionals, you know, trained filmmakers are coming in. They're coming back to the business again, and they're trying to revive the industry.
How do you handle distribution, and how are people able to actually see the work that you produce?
Well, in Nigeria, at least, we have a very good distribution network in Nigeria for our local consumers. So generally, the marketers have outlets all scattered all over the country. So once a movie is released, they get their distributors and it gets to the, you know, consumers.
Jamie, what's the purpose of the documentary that you did about Nigerian filmmaking besides to expose it to the rest of the world that may not know what's taking place there?
I think for me, the film is also about showing a different side of Africa at large, because I think in the U.S., as consumers of media, we don't really get a fair picture of what's going on in Africa, of the complexity of African countries and people. And so I thought this kind of a film that focuses on a very positive part of African life and something that Nigerian directors and filmmakers and producers, you know, creating this industry on their own, you know, have created something without any outside support or anything like that, that kind of story. Again, that inspirational kind of story for me felt very different than any other stories I'd seen being represented in our media about Africa. And to me, that was kind of an important point that I wanted to get across.
Izu, just a couple of more things. How difficult is it to do some of the more complicated kinds of crash scenes and explosions and things, fires and all that stuff that you see in action films. In the documentary, they showed how, you know, you guys put the blood in the water when they had the war scene and stuff. How hard is it to get those things that Hollywood is now generating via computer?
It is difficult, you know, in the sense like in the movie I shot while Jamie was in Nigeria, it took me 7 months to get the attention of the Nigerian army. And it's the first time they would give that kind of support to an independent filmmaker, to any filmmaker at all. So I stayed and then, you know, was constantly visiting the Army headquarters until the Army Chief of Staff, you know, approved those props. And I had bomb engineers, you know, on set. So, I mean, it's the first time anything like that is happening in Nigeria. So it indicates that the future is bright for the Nigerian movie industry.
Jamie, you want to add anything to that, what you've seen in comparing films made in Nollywood versus those you've seen made in Hollywood?
You know, there's all kinds of films being made in Nigeria, political thrillers and action movies. And so it's a really interesting industry to me in terms of, you know, continually defining itself and redefining itself. It's also very responsive to the news cycle. I mean, think about it. In the U.S., we can't be as responsive to our news cycle because it takes us several years to make a film. But in Nigeria, if you can make a film in a month or 6 weeks and get it out, you can be really responsive to what's happening in the news media. So there was a lot of talk about those kinds of films, whether it reflect political reality or some sort of social reality.
Jamie, Isu, thank you both.
Thank you.
Fascinating. Good
Thanks.
Luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Jamie Meltzer, director of the documentary Welcome to Nollywood, along with Nigerian film director Izu Ujuku. What would the movie Jaws be without that deep bass cello refrain? Or Psycho without the shrieking strings during that shower scene? Memorable films are often infused with a great musical score. ASCAP, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, runs a summer boot camp for hopeful composers. The annual summer film scoring workshop selects a dozen applicants from hundreds of hopefuls. The workshop closes with the participants conducting their music on a soundstage with a live orchestra. Michael Bearden, a product of the ASCAP workshop, has since scored Spike Lee and Vanessa Williams productions, and he joins us right now here in our studios at NPR West. Michael, nice to have you.
Thank you.
Let's begin with this. How did the ASCAP workshop prepare you for the real-world pressures of Hollywood film scoring?
The first thing that I learned at the ASCAP film scoring workshop is there are a lot of talented composers out here. And it prepares you in a way that they only give you a certain amount of time to score for a big Hollywood scene. And then it's pretty much like the real live pressures of how we score today. And we're given an orchestra to score, like a big 80-piece plus orchestra at the Fox scoring stage. And they'll show us a scene, and then we'll just have to score for it.
Really, you scored a 2006 documentary about the career of U.S. Representative Cynthia McKinney. We happen to have a piece of that music. Let's take a listen to it. This is a track from American Blackout. So, Michael, tell us, what were you thinking about when you composed that music, and how do you translate the look and the tone of a film into an effective score?
That's a great question. Usually a director will give you some kind of direction as to what kind of mood he wants or she wants. And you have to interpret that language into musical language. So American Blackout is about the voter disenfranchisement of 2000 and 2004 with that whole voting debacle that happened. And so you have to kind of synthesize that into how it would feel and how it sounds, how the mood of it is. And so pretty much, you know, that's how you do it. You just get the feel of it and then try to interpret it musically.
Describe how that feels different than just composing music generally. I know you don't have the film element when you're just composing music.
And that's the exact thing. You don't have the visual element. The visual element pretty much dictates what it should be, unless you're just trying to go for something different. If you see something funny on there and then you have a scary, like you said, cello drone as far as Jaws, it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't match unless that's the element that you're trying to go for. So you're just trying to match the mood of what the visual is dictating to you. Now, what does scary sound like? What does happy sound like? What does warm sound like? That's up to a lot of composers' interpretation, but you can pretty much get the gist of, there's a big vocabulary of what that kind of feels like already.
You know, it seems like that would be a great thing to do, very creative. What does warm sound like?
Yeah.
You know, just thinking about that. What challenges, or what would you say some of the bigger challenges are trying to come up and meet those things that we just discussed?
The challenges are, for me and I think a lot of composers, is just not to display your talent so much. What I mean by that is you want to do everything you know. Oh, you've trained and you have this thing, you go, oh, I want to show them this, but it might not call for that. As a friend of mine who's a great composer said, if they ask you for a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, just give them that.
That's interesting. In film scoring,
yes,
is less more?
Less is more. The thing about film scoring that you want is, once again, the visual dictates everything. So if you're walking out of the theater humming the score, you didn't do a good job.
Well, that's interesting. So you want to feel it but not think about it.
You want to feel it and not think about it. It's this whole other dimension that adds to the scariness or the funniness or whatever the mood is.
Well, how'd you get to that from what I'm going to talk about now, which was being Madonna's music director for 9 years? That seems like a quantum leap to me.
Have you ever seen a Madonna show?
Actually, I have not.
Well, she's very visual in what she does, and as well as all the artists that I work for. And what they try to do is create a mood on stage in a short amount of time. And so it's pretty much just a natural, it's not a natural leap to be a musical director for a pop star than to actually score a film, but it's the same sensitivity as far as evoking mood from a crowd or trying to set a mood on stage, doing costume changes or lighting transitions or that kind of thing. And I've just always been intrigued by film scores and what they did and how they made you feel after you've viewed the film.
What's your training in? Is it in music or what exactly?
I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I started playing when I was around 5 years old. And, you know, I played with everybody pretty much you can name. Just a lot of a varied just array of different artists, from Liza Minnelli to Madonna to D'Angelo to whatever hip hop guy to Boss Scaggs to whom.
Oh, you're not kidding. You played with
Jackson.
Everybody.
I mean, pretty much everybody. And so my training was pretty much that. I call it Street University.
You like this better?
I like it better because I don't have to get on a plane.
Well, I suppose, but what if a movie, well, I guess you're right. Even if a movie is done overseas, you don't necessarily have to go there.
Well, what I mean by that, Tony, is I remember the first tour I did with Whitney, I think we did about 18 months, like off and on the road, on buses, on planes, on that, and that kind of thing can just really drain you. Right now, you know, I can have a meeting with a director and it's down the street from my house. So I prefer that right now.
You're involved in a project. We're going to play it in a moment. Are you excited about this newest piece of film scoring that you're doing?
Which one is it?
The one that I have here is Rosa's Lament.
That's an old film that I did. It's a film called Constellation that's actually out right now. I think it's on cable now. I saw it on cable the other day.
Oh, you're smiling. You liked it, huh?
I like that film. It was a different kind of film. It was with Billy Dee Williams, Ray Don Chong. I think Leslie Ann Warren, Zoe Saldana's in it. Clarence Williams III is in it. And it's a lot of Hill Harper's in it. It's a varied cast. I like ensemble art type pieces.
You know, we had Billy Dee Williams in here talking about that film. As we're going to go out with a score from it. The song is called Rose's Lament. Michael Bearden, thank you so much
for
coming in.
Thank you so
much
for having me.
That's beautiful. Michael Bearden is a keyboardist, arranger, and composer of film scores. He joined us right here in our studios at NPR West.